We're the ones who get to be the bad guys, and we're the ones who have to make the tough decisions.
State health officials say the Republican health care bill would be devastating for Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a North Pole and Fairbanks group tackles air quality monitoring.
There's just so many people that doubt that A, the air is as bad as it is in North Pole, B, that there's a health problem for it, and C, that these monitors could even have an inkling of being accurate.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
Alaska's top health official says the federal health care bill scheduled for a vote on Thursday would devastate the Medicaid program in the state. The bill's effect on Alaska has prompted Representative Don Young to say today he won't vote for it in its current form. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Alaska Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Nuchavlaluk-Davidson says the Republican bill called the American Health Care Act would hurt Medicaid in a few different ways. She says the bill shifts responsibility onto states at a time when Alaska can't afford it. Davidson says the state would have to cut eligibility and benefits in the program.
I get nervous every time I hear a member of Congress talking about the great savings to the Medicaid program, because what they're saying is it's a savings to the federal government, and they're not saying it's a savings to states. They're actually shifting that cost to states, and that's a problem for Alaska.
Currently, the federal government reimburses states based on their Medicaid costs. So when costs go up, so do the reimbursements. Under the bill, the federal government pays a fixed rate per person, and healthcare experts don't expect federal payment increases to match rising Medicaid costs. Davidson also is concerned that the bill would require people on Medicaid to apply twice a year rather than once annually. This will raise state costs to administer the program. But more importantly, the bill would cut federal reimbursements for patients who move on and off Medicaid as their income rises and falls.
That's particularly a problem for a state like Alaska, where we have a significant seasonal workforce.
Davidson noted that Medicaid expansion has brought nearly $400 million in health spending to provide care for more than 30,000 Alaskans. Nearly 150,000 more Alaskans receive Medicaid and could receive reduced services. Davidson's also skeptical of federal officials who say they want to give states more flexibility. She says it leaves states with bad choices.
We're the ones who get to be the bad guys, and we're the ones who have to make the tough decisions.
Alaska Congressman Don Young says he won't vote for the bill in its current form. Young says the federal share of Medicaid costs is one area under discussion this week before the House vote.
One of my frustrations in watching this bubbling cauldron of indecision is, in fact, this is part of the program that's going to be changed. And there's a lot of thoughts out there, a lot of deals, but I'm not going to put the burden back on the state.
Young wants to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, but he says the bill as drafted isn't fair to Alaska because it doesn't adequately recognize the very high costs of medical care in the state.
If I think that we've come together, the delegation has, on fair, equitable treatment to Alaskans, I'll probably vote for the bill. But if it's not there, I'll vote against the bill because it's really not the repeal of Obamacare as we originally said we were going to do.
Davidson says she's communicated her concerns to the state's delegation in Congress. With help from Liz Ruskin in Washington, in Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Fairbanks and North Pole have suffered numerous Clean Air Act violations again this winter due to fine particulates from wood, coal, and other burning. Smoke pollution persists despite long-term government efforts to assess and remedy the problem. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a local group has taken air quality monitoring into their own hands.
It's an off day at the office of North Pole veterinarian Jean Olson, with time to focus on the problem that's forced her to install an air filtration system at her clinic and now an air monitoring station in the yard.
We went from thinking about the possibility that we could do this, and a week later it was up and going.
That's in part due to the nimbleness of the small group Citizens for Clean Air Olson co-coordinates. She says they contacted Oregon-based manufacturer of high-tech air monitoring machines, MET-1, and were loaned a unit called a beta attenuation monitor, or BAM, and set it up in a tent in her yard.
So, this is the BAM. This is the expensive $20,000 gadget. And this is a piece of insulation because there's actually a heater in here that preheats the air at a known volume. In a little while, this pump's going to come on, and it'll be way noisy in here for us. But right now, it's just sitting there thinking and measuring and doing stuff.
The BAM is the same EPA-approved unit the North Star Borough officially gauges air quality with in downtown Fairbanks and North Pole. The Citizens for Clean Air station also includes a more basic-style monitor the borough deploys in local neighborhoods. Olson says the combination enables on-site assessment in what's perceived to be a very smoky neighborhood, as well as a way to compare readings from the two types of monitors.
Our neighborhood monitors have never really been thoroughly vetted and tested, especially in the cold temperatures and the high levels. So that was why it was really important for us to put a BAM and a neighborhood monitor together, simultaneously measuring the same basic air in the same area.
Olson says Citizens for Clean Air tried to work with the borough to get the information, but became frustrated.
The approval process was going to take way too long, and rather than wait another whole season, we said, well, let's just see if we can figure out how to do it ourselves.
Olson maintains the citizen monitoring project is not about going rogue, and says they'll share all their data with an end goal of cleaning up local air.
There's just so many people that doubt that A, the air is as bad as it is in North Pole, B, that there's a health problem for it, and C, that these monitors could even have an inkling of being accurate.
North Pole routinely violates federal air quality standards during the winter months, and Olson says the BAM monitor on her property one day registered a fine particulate level in excess of 250 micrograms per cubic meter, far above the EPA threshold of 35. EPA officials in town this week to discuss air quality issues with the borough plan to meet with Citizens for Clean Air and view their monitoring station. In North Pole, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lessons from the kitchen that go well beyond cooking.
People are okay, I guess.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A new culinary school that teaches more than the difference between saute and simmer opened in Anchorage last fall to provide classes for people who are homeless or are leaving prison. Instructors at Feed Me Hope go beyond teaching cooking skills to teach life skills. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman checked out the program.
Julia Moore walks through the kitchen at the Hope Center downtown soup kitchen in Anchorage, pointing at the vegetable prep area and giant freezers. Then she remembers something way more important.
Oh, let's go check my dessert. I forgot my dessert in the oven.
She rushes across the crowded room and pulls a large metal tray of apple crumble out of the oven.
Smell that.
She says she loves baking desserts because, unlike vegetables, they make people the happiest.
I can't get excited about chopping up yams, you know?
Moore is midway through the 12-week-long culinary program at the soup kitchen. She joined the school because the conditions of her release from prison into a halfway house required that she get a job, and she wasn't having any luck.
And I mean, I was applying at Wendy, I was applying everywhere, and nobody was interested. You know, I have a lot of tattoos, I'm older, I hadn't been employed in over 10 years.
Now, every morning she joins 10 other students for training that applies to all jobs, not just kitchen etiquette. For the first half of the day, they take life skills classes. Then, in the afternoon, they learn to cook. Everything the students prepare is served for dinner to the 50 women who sleep at the Hope Center, which is a soup kitchen by day and an emergency shelter by night. The program is privately funded through donations and catering sales. Chef David Sorensen teaches the cooking classes. He says the skills he imparts, how to hold a knife, how to make vinaigrette, are important, but it won't necessarily help his students keep a job. First, they need to learn to deal with their inner gremlins.
With those voices, i.e. gremlins in your head, they're telling you you're not good enough, you're a failure, you can't do this. If we can't get them to a point where they can overcome those voices, they won't be gainfully employed, and that's the reason why they're here.
So while he teaches them to dice peppers, he also talks about his life and checks in on how the students are doing outside of class. Sorensen says he's been where many of his students have. He's in recovery from alcohol addiction and was homeless when he was young.
In the past, if somebody had said, hey, I've got a culinary job for you as a teacher, I would have not lasted 2 months. I would have just said, would have chucked it all in and said, nah, I can't do this, you know, because I would have still been not sober.
Sobriety is one of the program requirements. Students undergo random drug tests and are asked to use a breathalyzer if program staff suspect they're drinking. Sorensen says people who are caught using will get another shot at staying in the program, but they have to agree to stop using substances. Feed Me Hope is modeled after Fair Start in Seattle, which has run a culinary and life skills program for 30 years. 90% of their adult graduates get jobs within 3 months of finishing the program. So far, three people have graduated from Feed Me Hope in Anchorage. 11 more are on track to finish in late spring, and Moore is one of them. She says she doesn't plan on getting a culinary job when she finishes, but she's definitely learned some things that will help her in life.
I don't work well with others. I do better by myself. That's why I'm an artist. But I'm getting used to working with people, and which is a good thing. People are okay, I guess.
Moore pulls her dessert out of the oven, the edges brown and bubbly, then heads into the walk-in refrigerator to make the final preparations for the night's meal. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Last week, members of Teamsters Local 959 were informed by the union that a break-in had occurred at their building on January 26th, and personal information for those members who were contacted had been compromised. This information includes names and social security numbers. Local 959 Secretary Treasurer Rick Boyles refused a recorded interview, but said this is the first building break-in in about 8 years. The stolen objects included a petty cash safe, which included three employer reports that contained personal employee information. Boyle says the number of affected members was a small percentage of overall membership, but he declined to give a number. Controller Chris Lira stated most of the affected members were from Anchorage, but there were several who lived outside Anchorage. Boyle says the building had security in place and the local 959, as well as other community members, were working with police to find the parties responsible for the theft. He also says the Teamsters building had security systems before the break-in, and they have increased their building security since. When informed their personal information may have been compromised, the affected members were given information on how to protect their personal accounts. They were instructed to use a free fraud alert system with credit reporting agencies. Jimmy Settle knows what it is to struggle back to health after being shot in the head. Settle and co-author Don Reardon recently released their new book, Never Quit. It tells the story of Settle's experiences as a pararescueman in the Alaska Air National Guard and his time in Afghanistan in the elite 212th pararescue unit known as the PJs. The PJs are highly skilled rescue personnel who train by plucking stranded hikers off mountains or pulling mariners out of frigid seas. I spoke with both authors. Among other stories, the book chronicles Settle's story about heavy fighting in the Wadapur Valley in Afghanistan.
It's the one that stands out the most in my mind because it is the, you know, that's when I got shot, and that's also when my other team, I had to leave my teammates behind on the ground in a pretty hairy firefight. And one of the parts of being a pararescueman is you make this oath to never leave your brothers behind, you know, and so that's a very hard thing to do. So it's a raw one for me. And since it's so personal to me, I can pull from the well a whole lot of descriptions about everything that was going on there.
You have received a Purple Heart and other honors. You mentioned it's helped you with a lot of the things that came after your experience. What are some of those things?
Well, when I came back from Afghanistan, I had a hard time transitioning at first. You know, I had a lot of really intrusive nightmares, intrusive thoughts. I clearly had PTSD. It's something I'm still managing. It's a monkey that's on my back that has, it's not fully gone away, but I just learned to kind of live with it.
Beyond the medals, you've saved numerous lives. After you save someone's life, is there a connection that continues with that person?
I didn't really have the opportunity to establish relationships with many of the folks I rescued because usually it was very chaotic and the back of the helicopter is kind of noisy. Unlike what you see in the Hollywood movies, it's very difficult to have a conversation in the back of a helicopter. But working with Don, he's done a lot of legwork researching some of these guys and kind of feeling out what's happened, some of the aftermath. And that's been really cool because I personally didn't have the strength for that. Having Don in my corner really, I mean, this is a strong guy. And sometimes us hardcore rescue guys need a little help too.
Have you and your former team members stayed in contact and maybe continue to support each other or help each other through some of the things you were discussing, PTSD? And
at first, I didn't have the strength to reach back out. When I first came back, I was very much a man alone, but it was really cool because my brothers didn't give up on me. The guys I served with, they kept calling me and checking on me and taking care of me. And if anything, it's really hardened some of these relationships.
Does the book feel like a form of therapy to have this down on paper?
This book was very, very, very therapeutic. It was not easy for me to do. And in fact, if it wasn't for Don, this would never have happened. I had many mental health professionals and a lot of other people tell me, journal, dude, just journal. Like, you're having these hard times. You need to just start writing it down. And every time I tried, the pen would be too heavy or what I wrote down wouldn't be right. With Don's help, like he really helped me out a lot.
Mr. Reardon, let's get you in here. How did you get connected to Jimmy and get on? I mean, you don't have a military background, so how did this come about?
So I met Jimmy when he was dating a good friend of mine. And yeah, he was working at Skinny Raven and I was in graduate school and he was just this crazy fun guy. And we got along really well. And even then, as soon as I started hearing his story, we started cracking jokes about it. I was like, I'm going to write a goofy screenplay about your life. And we called him Shoe Guy. Part of the backstory is he would go through the selection course to become a PJ. And when he'd come home, he would return, like he'd have little breaks and I would get to see him and he would tell me the stories of what he was going through, this just incredibly intense training. And so he would share those stories with me. And in a way, I became the keeper of some of Jimmy's stories, because then once he got injured and he had a traumatic brain injury, he couldn't remember some of that stuff. And I knew some of those stories. And I remembered the details from them because they were so amazing to me.
That was Don Reardon and Jimmy Settle discussing their new book, Never Quit, about life as a Special Forces pararescueman in the PJs. Links to the book are at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
In the last legislature, a Democrat-sponsored bill aimed at increasing voter turnout, especially in rural Alaska. It didn't get a single hearing in the Republican-led House of Representatives. Now, Representative Chris Tuck, an Anchorage Democrat, is in a powerful position leading the new House majority and has reintroduced the legislation. KTOO's Caroline Halter reports.
Cindy Allred works for Get Out the Native Vote, an organization that has been active registering and encouraging voting amongst Alaska Natives, many of whom live in rural areas.
We do have a big concern that there are more challenges to registering to vote in rural Alaska, to voting in rural Alaska as well. Many of the communities don't have the early voting stations. There are communities in Alaska that don't even have a polling station.
Get Out the Native Vote put their weight behind passing the PFD voter registration and has been working with Tuck on House Bill 1.
There's a couple of us who just got together and said, how can we help modernize Alaskan system? How can we try to make it more equitable?
Tuck's bill is comprehensive. It would give people the option to vote permanently by mail and allow for same-day registration, among other things. Grace Mullapola worked on Get Out the Native Vote in Bristol Bay.
Some of the people are not there on election day, either because they have doctor's appointments or they're out doing their subsistence. I think that's one of the biggest barriers throughout the state of Alaska.
In addition to getting people registered to vote, Mullapola helped set up early voting stations in Bristol Bay for general elections. According to Division of Elections data, general election turnout there has fluctuated. Increases in early voting sites and registration haven't always coincided with higher voter turnout. Tuck's bill ensures that early voting stations stay the same year after year, but it doesn't directly address the number or placement of such voting sites. According to Division of Elections, since 2010, the number of early voting sites in Alaska has increased from 73 to 169. So why didn't this bill go anywhere last session? Tuck chalked it up to partisan politics.
We had a different makeup of the legislature. We had different majority-minority situation. This year, I went from being minority leader to majority leader. And we're not going to be treating people the way that we were treated because we weren't allowed to have our bills heard.
Rural Alaska tends to vote blue, which means higher turnout in the bush may help Democrats in statewide races. Former Democratic U.S. Senator Mark Begich invested heavily in rural Alaska in his 2014 campaign against Republican Dan Sullivan. His brother, Tom Begich, worked on the campaign before being elected last year to represent District J in the Alaska Senate.
In my brother's U.S. Senate race, early voting was a critical issue for us.
The campaign hired organizers in 40 villages and set up 16 offices from Barrow to Bethel.
When we analyzed where there was early voting and where there wasn't at the time, we noted that where there wasn't early voting, turnouts tended to be a little bit lower.
The rural vote was instrumental in Begich's 2008 win against longtime Republican incumbent Ted Stevens in 2008. But Begich lost his seat to Sullivan in 2014, despite investing heavily in rural Alaska. Early voting is only one part of Tuck's bill, but it could be a boon for rural communities. For now, House Bill 1 is being workshopped in the House State Affairs Committee. In Juneau, I'm Caroline Halter.
Roxy Wright won the Open North American Championship sled dog race in Fairbanks over the weekend. The hometown favorite was followed by defending ONAC champ Buddy Steeper of British Columbia and his wife Lena in the three-stage 70-mile sprint competition. KUAC's Robin reports.
Roaring up the hill, here comes Roxy Wright.
This is the fourth time 66-year-old Roxy Wright has won both of Alaska's two big sprint races in the same year. That's the Open North American in Fairbanks and the Fur Rendezvous Open World Championship in Anchorage. But she had a two-decade gap. Wright retired from sprint mushing in 1996 and didn't expect to compete again. Until last year when she entered the Open North American and came in second behind Buddy Streeper. This year, she won by 24 seconds.
Here comes Roxy. She is over.
Race Marshal Mike McGowan says the third day really mattered this year. Going into Sunday's heat, Roxy Wright held a 20 seconds lead over last year's champion Buddy Streeper, who was 2 minutes ahead of Salter rookie Amy Dunlap.
This race this year turned into one of the best races competition-wise that we've had in a long time.
A clear sky and temperatures around 20 degrees Fahrenheit kept the dogs from overheating and the fans happy. I'm Robin in Fairbanks.
The 2017 Iditarod Sled Dog Race is over. The 45th running, rerouted from Fairbanks to Nome, came to an end last night with the finisher's banquet held at the Nome Rec Center. Each musher was recognized individually, starting with this year's Red Lantern, Cindy Abbott.
2 years ago, I was still out on the trail during the banquet. And this year, I came in 32 hours faster. To still get the Red Lanterns, and I'm a pair.
Before all 64 mushers took to the podium to share stories from the trail and thank family and sponsors, special awards were handed out. Mitch Seavey's lead dog Pilot received the City of Nome Lolly Medley Memorial Golden Harness Award. Nicholas Petit received the Nome Kennel Club Award for fastest time from safety to Nome in 2 hours and 27 minutes.
Fast dogs are fun to drive.
But after Petit's show of sportsmanship for handing over Dallas Seavey's dropped vet book at the finish line, it was Alan Moore that was selected by fellow mushers for the 2017 Sportsmanship Award.
When I think about this award, I think about the diphtheria happened so long ago. People were helping people. And when I see someone out there, you know, in distress or trouble, I like to help them. So, thank you very much.
Rookie of the Year went to Frenchman Sebastian Vernou, who placed 23rd, as well as most improved musher Ryan Reddington, who jumped up 22 places since his last Iditarod finish in 2009. Western Alaska mushers stretched across the field this year. Bethel's Pete Kaiser placed 9th, while fiancés John Baker and Catherine Keith of Kotzebue crossed the finish line in 18th and 19th place. Richie Deal of Antioch finished in 24th, while Nome's Noah Burmeister arrived in 29th. Melissa Stewart took 33rd behind Martin Boozer, and Paul Hansen, a rookie from Kotzebue, rounded out the group of Western Alaska mushers, finishing 61st. A total of 8 mushers scratched in the 2017 race. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Robin in Fairbanks, Andrew Kitchenman and Caroline Halter in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Margaret DeMiorbis in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.